All right, we're ready to start on an adventure together. It's going to last for 20 weeks. Well, some of those weeks will be I'll not be able to be here, and so it really works out to be about 18 classes to cover 22 of the one book of the Bible nobody can ever understand. And so I'm glad you're in a class that where we're going to study one book in the Bible that you never would be able to understand. There are 66 books in the Bible, and one of them you understand all 65 of them, but one of them you cannot understand. You know which one that is, don't you? What is the name of this book? Revelation. What's that mean? Now look, I'm not an English teacher. If you want to use the word to define Revelation, that's all right with me. I never understood that stupid rule my English teachers had starting in about the third or fourth grade. You cannot use the same word to define a word. Yes, I can. I do it all the time. You know, what do you mean I cannot do it? It's the way you define it. A revelation means to reveal. And we've got to understand that. We ought not to approach this book thinking, well, nobody would ever, ever be able to understand this book. Let's get to the study of the book. And so we start with the class number one, and it's the introduction of the book, and that's where we are. Now, the amazing thing is, this is the most vital lesson there will be, and there will be those who will be joining the class later today. Those coming in later are going to be lost. We're going to hit the heavy stuff right here on the front end. And we'll come back to this and talk about it some other times, but I want you to understand, if you'd been a first century Christian and you had received this book, there are four vital truths that you would understand about this book. Open your Bible or look at the screen, either one. Revelation chapter 1, verse 1. Look at those verses that are there and look at what they say. There are four keys to understanding this book. Look at the second word in the text. God says, I am going to reveal something to you. It is a revelation. In fact, in the Greek, it's the first word. The Greek text starts off with the word revelation. Revelation of Jesus Christ. And so, the point number one, there are four keys to understanding the book. Key number one, it is a revelation. If you're going to understand this, you've got to understand God did not put this book in here to confuse you. He put this book in here to help you to understand some things you never would have understood if there were not the other books in the Bible. It is a revelation. How do I know that? Well, the text says the revelation of Jesus Christ. I've highlighted and I think put it in all caps, the word revelation, to help you notice the importance of this. God expects us to be able to understand this. It is a revelation to seven churches in Asia. One of the reasons we don't understand this book is we're not in Asia. We do not understand that first century culture. And one of the things we're going to do today in this class is to look at the Bible description of that culture. The reason we do not understand the book of Revelation is we don't understand what it would have been like to have been a New Testament Christian. But these New Testament Christians, they would have bought into 666 just like that. They would have had no problem. They never saw one televangelist, and they could figure it out. When we get over there to talk about 666, we're going to show how that comes out. But look what he says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants. Now look at verse 11 if you've got your text open. Verse 11 tells who those servants are. You write these things in a book to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, and Laodicea. And I left out one of them. I don't know which one I left out. Let me try it again. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos. I left out Pergamos. That's one I left out. Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And the way Crazy Dan remembers that is you just use ESP. Have you ever heard of ESP, extra sensory perception? I'm going to give it to you right now. Ready? You're getting ESP. E for Ephesus. S for Smyrna. ESP. Y or ESP. P for Pergamos. Now, TSP, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and you already knew Laodicea, so I didn't have to tell you that one. So those are the seven churches in Asia. And so all of a sudden, John's on the Isle of Patmos, and he gets this book. And when he gets this book, they arrive at services, and they not all of them can read. Look down at verse 3. Verse 3 says, blessed is that individual that reads and those that hear. Perhaps an indication of the fact that there were those who were illiterate in the first century. And so imagine being just an uneducated commoner there in one of those seven churches, and you sit down, and here's a book, The Revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show to his servants, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. I'm going to show you some things there. And when you read it, there's a blessing. And when you hear it, now, none of us are illiterate, I'm assuming. We all can read. And so hearing would indicate thinking about it, listening to what you read. But that's exactly what the individual would have to do that heard somebody reading it to him. He'd have to listen to it. And so it's the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto his servants. Third point, it's not only a revelation to the seven churches in Asia, it's a revelation to the seven churches in Asia in signs. And I've re-hyphenated the word sign in the text that's on the screen to indicate this is exactly what the Greek word says. It is the word for sign turned into a verb. And I guess that's what signify is. Signify is something that stands for something else. And so I've got the word signified highlighted on the screen and hyphenated different. To signify. There are signs in the book of Revelation. We ought not to come to this book expecting it to be a historical book. It is not a historical book. It's a different kind of book, has that prophetical language that's characteristic of a lot of the Old Testament books, you know, that we've been studying, like Isaiah, and we're studying Jeremiah now. A lot of that kind of prophetic. How are you going to deal with this? Well, here's the way. I'll make up my signs, you make up your signs, and guess what? The sign I make up and the sign you make up would be equally as good as the sign made up by the televangelist on channel 34, but the televangelist on channel 76, his signs are no better than yours, but they're just as good as yours. Here's what people do. They come to the book of Revelation, and when they get to the book of Revelation, they think, boy, I wonder if I can figure out what this sign means. The answer is no. It is not up to a subjective thing to understand this book. Subjective means everybody thinks, well, I think it could mean this. Okay, go right ahead. Your thoughts are just as good as my thoughts. Your thoughts are as good as the televangelist, except he's writing a whole lot more books on it to make a whole lot more money than you are. But it's not up to us. If you'd been a member of one of the seven churches in Asia, how would you have been able to understand the signs? Three sources they had, and it's the only three sources that we have. Three sources they had. Number one, they had the entirety of the Old Testament. So many of the signs, and you'll see this as we study this book, so many of the signs in the book of Revelation are mentioned elsewhere in the Bible. You read about stars falling out of heaven, and you read about Jesus coming in, or about the Lord coming in the clouds. You read about the water being turned into blood. You read about all kinds of things in the Old Testament. And the understanding of those things in the Old Testament would be the things that would help you. So in the church, there are Jews. In the church, in these seven churches. And so whenever they get to reading about the lamb and the lion, these pagans didn't have a clue what it was all about. They would have scratched their head. How on earth? Who is this lion and who is this lamb? You know how different a lion is from a lamb? And so they'd sit there just absolutely, nobody would ever be able to understand this book. And some Jewish brother says, well, let me tell you about this in the Old Testament and this in the Old Testament. And because you understand the lion and the lamb in the Old Testament, you can understand it. But don't listen to the televangelist. Go to what the Bible says. Let the Bible define what these signs are. And then there were Gentiles that were there who could know like 666. They could know somewhat about the culture. And we don't have the greatest of ability of understanding that culture. signs in the Old Testament, those Gentiles who could give them an understanding of those culture in the seven churches of Asia. If you're in the church in the first century and you're way down in the land of Egypt, or if you're in some other distant land, you're over in Persia, you might struggle as much as Americans do about trying to understand things that are cultural in that passage. There are very few of them, but so we're not dependent on the culture to understand this. So you've got the Old Testament, you've got the teachings of Jesus. In that New Testament church, there could have been Palestinian Christians who had obeyed the gospel and who were now in those seven churches, and they heard the parables of Jesus. And that'll become evident a little bit longer. And other than that, there is no way to figure out what that fourth hump from the back on that dinosaur in chapter 13, what that fourth hump represents. Why? That's subjective. Why would you even think it had some symbolism? You see, John is seeing a vision. And not everything in a vision represents something else. When that bed sheet came down from heaven in Acts chapter 10, where God was trying to teach Peter that the Gentiles were to be accepted, there are pigs inside that sheet. Wonder what those pigs represent? And there are camels inside that sheet. Wonder what that represents? And there are pelicans inside that sheet. And there are all of these animals that are inside the sheet. And if you go there and you try to figure out what that pig or that pelican or whatever animal is there, that it has some symbolism and it means something, you'll never understand what that bed sheet is all about in Acts chapter 10. It's a vision that John sees, and in order that we might, through his writing, see what he saw. We'll see this in chapter 1 when we see the description of Jesus. Why did the feet of Jesus look like polished brass? Well, you can be subjective about it. Well, brass is shiny and Jesus shines. That's a little light of mine. I'm going to let it shine. Let your light so shine before men. And so the polished brass feet of Jesus indicates Christians ought to let their light shine. How's that for being subjective? I made that up. I couldn't prove that if I had to. You know the significance of it? Significance of it is John saw it and John told us about it. Now, if the Bible makes that significant, then we can make it significant. But if John is just saying, I saw Jesus and his hair was white. His hair was white like snow. His hair was white like wool. Well, I wonder what it's like, wonder what that wool symbolized. Well, it comes off of a sheep, and Jesus is the Lamb of God. Wonderful, has nothing at all to do with the fact he did not have sheep hair on his head. John said, I'm going to tell you what his hair looked like. It looked like white wool, it looked like snow. Well, it's cold, and cold, snow is cold, and therefore Jesus is warm-hearted but cold-headed. That's what people do in the book of Revelation. You know the significance of it? John saw it and John told us about it, and it has no significance unless we want to just run out on the subjective. But when we head out this path over here on this subjective element, you better recognize I've left the Scriptures. And in this class, there'll be times some people say, well, you think it could mean? And my answer is, yep, it could mean that. That's your idea. It's as good as a televangelist idea. Does the Scriptures make that significant to us? If it doesn't, there's no way we'll be able to understand it. It is symbolic in its nature. Fourth key, it's a revelation to seven churches in Asia in signs, and look at it, of things which must shortly happen. Here is the point that almost everyone misses. If you'd been a member in the first century church, you'd been that illiterate person sitting in the church, and there's a message that says, here's a message that's come from John on the Isle of Patmos. Wonder what this is all about. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto his servants to show unto his servants things which must shortly happen. What would you have understood that to mean? How on earth can you make shortly longly? If longly, is that a good word? I'm not saying lonely, I'm long, L-O-N-G-L-Y. How can you make shortly lonely? That's what people do. And so when they talk about all the signs are right, Jesus is going to come about, if the signs of the book of Revelation have to do with what's happening in the 21st century, it is not a message to the first century church, and it was not a revelation to them. And if we've got to know all the history of all of the churches and denominationalism, how it all developed, if we've got to be a historical scholar to be able to understand the book of Revelation, folks, this book is a revelation to illiterate Asians. And we need to approach it and be just as intelligent as illiterate Asians. Whatever the sources he had, we'll take every one of those sources. But if you've got to be a PhD and have unbelievable scholarship in relationship to this to be able to understand all of these things, you are in a heaping lot of trouble, because if you're in the first century church and it has to do with the Pope, has to do with the Muslim religion, has to do with Moscow and the Cold War and Hitler, and that's what people subjectively have made this book to be all about, it is not a revelation of those seven churches in Asia. Those individuals would have understood. Speak, John, and speak loud so I can hear. Yeah, that's where I'm headed next. Look at verse 3. Look down at verse 3. Look at verse 3. Look at what's highlighted in verse 3. For the time is at hand. The time is near. When you read Matthew chapter 3, verse 2, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, you're reading the same thing. If you'd heard John preach to that, what would you have thought? You would have thought that the kingdom of heaven was at hand. Matthew 4:17, Jesus preached the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And you would have understood that. Why? Because you know what at hand means. You understand that. God is trying to write to these seven churches in Asia. God is not trying to write a document to God so that you've got to have the wisdom of God, to whom one day is as a thousand years. And so I read about 3.5 days in the book of Revelation. That's 3,500 years with God. God did not write this book to God. It's a revelation of those seven churches in Asia. And that's the approach that we're going to take in this book. And it is unbelievable, fundamental, because if you ignore these first three verses, you will not understand this book. You will be forced to go down a subjective road, and you'll never be able to understand. Now then, let's talk about our becoming a part of the first century world. How do we become a part of that first century world? Well, what was it like? What it would have been like to be in the first century world? I want us to take, and listen to me, divine history. Divine history is the book of Acts. Here is what happened in the first 30 plus years of the history of the church. And those individuals who have taught the book of Revelation have come to us and given us a wrong view of that first century world. Let me ask you this. Was the Roman government trying to destroy Christianity from its very beginning? And in our mind, yeah, Rome did everything. The Caesars hated Rome. Everybody hated, Caesars hated Jerusalem. Was Rome an enemy of Christianity in the first century? And if you come to the book of Revelation, and I'm not saying that Rome is not found in the book of Revelation. We'll put it in the place when it comes up in the text. But if our approach is the only enemy that Christians had in the first century was the Roman government, that had it not been for the Roman government, the church would have just scattered, is as wrong as it can be. Look, for example, in the first five or six chapters, starting in Acts chapter 2. They were having favor with all the people, and the Lord added unto the church daily those that were being saved. That was an unbelievable atmosphere. Acts 2:47, I quoted. There was an acceptance of the church in an unbelievable manner right when it first started. Now then, there was some Jewish opposition. They take Peter and John in chapters 4 and 5 and put Peter and John in prison. What's happened there out among the multitudes? The Jews are becoming a Christian. Acts chapter 6 says, a great company of the priests obeyed the gospel. The church was having great, great favor. And so you read of the number 3,000. You read of that number being multiplied. That's not adding. The Lord added to the church. And then you multiply. You get a whole lot bigger numbers when you start multiplying. And the multitudes. And so the church is just in an unbelievable situation. And then all of a sudden, Acts chapter 6, where a great company of the priests become Christian, guess what happens in the latter part of Acts chapter 6? They take Stephen in the latter part of Acts chapter 6, and there is that Jewish persecution that comes up unbelievably in Acts chapter 6 and 7. All of a sudden, the church falls from favor, and the Jewish government does everything it can in Jerusalem. A lot of power in Jerusalem, not a lot of power in the seven churches in Asia, but a lot of power there in Jerusalem. And they do everything they can to destroy the church. They take Stephen out, and the last part of chapter 7, guess what they're doing? The last part of chapter 7, they're stoning Stephen. Look in chapter 8. You know the persecution about Saul? In last verses of chapter 7, Saul was consenting unto his death. And chapter 8, there's a great persecution that begins, and the disciples were scattered everywhere. And so now this church is growing by leaps and bounds in Jerusalem, is now spread everywhere except for the apostles, and they that were scattered abroad went everywhere preaching the word. Guess what happens whenever that kind of thing comes along? It's that persecution in Jerusalem. And look at chapter 9, verse 1. And Saul yet breathing out threatenings. He's still doing it. The word yet significant there. He's entering into the houses. That may be the early verses of chapter 8. He's entering into the houses and taking these Christians out. And in chapter 9, he gets letters from the Jewish Sanhedrin so he can go up to Damascus, go up to a Gentile city. You understand the church is up in Damascus? That's 133 miles the way the crow flies away from Jerusalem. And the church is already up there in significant enough numbers that they're there to, and Saul wants to destroy them. And so that persecution of those disciples in Damascus, it's Jewish. They got to deal with that Roman government, got to deal with that Syrian government that's there. But it is a Jewish-led opposition, and that's you have that to have that unbelievable persecution. Go to Acts chapter 12, next persecution. There we're looking at 22 persecutions in the book of Acts. That's what we're looking at right now. In Acts chapter 12, Herod beheads James. And that pleased the Jews, and so he is ready to take care of Paul, but he waits until after the Passover is there. Where's that persecution? Herod's half Jewish, appointed by the Roman government, but is an Idumean, half Jewish. It's Jewish persecution. And you need to understand the divine history of the Bible shows that the persecution of the early church, from the very time the persecution that starts, it's almost always Jewish. Look at in Acts chapter 13. Paul on his missionary journey arrives up in Turkey, up in Asia Minor, up in that part. And when he is in Antioch, he goes into the synagogue, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. That's what he always did, went to the synagogue. Guess what happened every time he got to the synagogue? Jews got angry at him. The Jews ran him out. That shows he wasn't in there keeping the Sabbath. I mean, he was in there trying to straighten them out and straighten up there. And they get so angry at him that they drive him out of the city. They drive him over to Iconium. That's in Acts chapter 14. And there the text says, unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles. They sat down and they came all the way from 40 miles over to Iconium and stirred up the Gentiles over there from Iconium and Lystra. How much do they hate Paul? Paul is stoned to death, at least seemingly dead, is stoned to death there in Lystra. That's Jewish persecution. Whenever he gets down to a Lystra, the Jews from Antioch and Iconium come down. Now you've got from two different cities, some of them 60 miles away from home, and he's down there preaching to these Gentiles, telling them they can go to heaven, be believers in God without being circumcised. And so they come down, and there they stone Paul in Lystra. There's Jewish persecution. Acts chapter 15 has to do with that conference they had in Jerusalem dealing with the matter of circumcision. When you get to Acts chapter 16, you arrive at the one, listen to this, you arrive at the one time in the book of Acts that the persecution is not Jewish. This is divine history. That's what I'm trying to say. And we have bought into the idea that the Roman government did everything, and I bought into it for years, you know, until you just really start saying, really, what would it have been like to be in those seven churches in Asia? You try to become that illiterate person there in the seven churches in Asia. And so this is the one time. What happens? He's in Philippi. He casts the demons out. There's a young lady, a damsel that has a spirit of divination, and people are making money out of her. Whenever he cleanses and casts this demon out of that young lady, he touches the most sensitive nerve in the human body. You know which one that is? It's not the one to your eye, not the one to your tongue, it's not the one to your big toe when you stumble, you know, you scuff it in the middle of the night walking through the house and everything. The most sensitive nerve in the human body is the one that goes to your wallet. And so what happens? They cast Paul into prison at Philippi. Has nothing at all to do with Roman persecution. Folks, we're 15, 20 years into the history of the church, and all persecution is Jewish. And so in Acts chapter 16, you've got the one time, and I put the word Roman there, and that's just because of their citizenship, but I put question mark because it's not the Roman government. Acts chapter 17, he goes to Thessalonica. Acts chapter 17, there is a riot that is caused as because Paul's in the synagogue, and they are stirred up. And so evidently the Jewish Christians by the name of Jason was brought to the Romans, now all of a sudden the Romans sort of get involved in this, but it's the Jews, as it were, riding on the back of the Roman government. The Roman government, and we'll show quotations from this, but the divine history shows it, the Roman government was not interested in Christianity in the book of Acts until the Jews stir up the Romans. And you've got to get that in your mind. So whenever we're talking about these seven churches in Asia, they didn't have to unlearn the thing that you and I have been taught all of our life. Yes, Henry, what do you have to say?
Who was the Roman people? Was it Jews or who?
Well, good question. All individuals in that first century world were not Roman citizens, but they were under the Roman power. But when I'm using the word Roman, I'm talking about the government. I'm talking about the government. I'm talking about our view is that from the very inception, the Roman government wanted to destroy Christianity. The Romans allowed the Greeks to keep their gods. The Romans preach peaceful religion. They preach freedom of religion until it conflicted with the Roman government. That's the only time. They let individuals, they let the Egyptians worship any way they want to. They let the Persians worship any way they wanted to. They practiced freedom of religion, to use terminology we would understand. But I'm not talking about secular history. I'm talking about divine history. So we got this problem in Thessalonica. In Acts 17, they go over to Berea. Guess what happens? Jews from Thessalonica come down to where those in Berea, more noble than those in Thessalonica, and they stir up the people there. And Paul is persecuted. So there is that Jewish persecution. Acts chapter 18. Paul is brought before Galileo in Corinth, and Sosthenes is beaten. They're brought before Galileo, the Roman official, and he tends those Jewish individuals, leave this courtroom. If this has to do with matters about your law, we have nothing to do with it. Folks, this is divine history. And yet we've bought into the fact that the that man, when the Jews got up into Turkey and went over into the where the seven churches in Asia were. They were all in Turkey. When he gets over into Corinth and Thessalonica and all of these other places, our view is the Roman government did everything it could to destroy Christianity. Roman government didn't want to destroy it. It didn't care what. They saw it as a Jewish denomination. Think about, you're a Roman. Here are the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Here are the Essenes. Here are the Herodians. And here's this new little group called the Christos. They're followers of Christ, Christians. And they're just seen as a Jewish denomination. Now, whenever, and we're jumping way ahead in AD 70, when Nero Caesar says, destroy Jerusalem, Jews became targets because they were the most visible aspect of the defenders of Jehovah God. And they became the focus of that persecution. But it doesn't last all of that long, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves. We'll get to this as we study the book of Revelation. In Acts chapter 8, 19, there's that riot that was in Ephesus. You know, my great is Diana of the Ephesians, that particular story. And the town clerk, the Roman guy in charge, calls all these people and says, we're going to get in trouble with the government. Here we are, not practicing what the government wants us to practice, and we're going to be called under the carpet because of this riot that we're having here. It was not Jewish in the sense that the riot was brought up by the silversmith, but whenever it got to the Roman officials, they said, we're not going to touch this. We'll get in trouble if we get involved in this at all. In Acts chapter 20, you remember those, even before he gets to Jerusalem, the Acts chapter 20 says the Jews lay in wait for Paul while he was over there in Greece, over in Corinth and over in that area. The Jews are ready to destroy Paul. And in Acts 21, Jews from Asia, when Paul gets to Jerusalem, were stirred up. And they stirred up the government, and the government went into the temple where there's a mob of Jews and rescued Paul. And then in Acts chapter 22, there's that Jewish riot continues, and Paul was beaten by the soldiers, by the Roman soldiers. And when the centurion, the captain of those individuals who had beat Paul, Roman soldiers who had beaten Paul, when they heard about it, he went in there and he rebuked them. This man's a Roman citizen. How can you be beating a Roman citizen? He's a defender, at least Paul, because of his Roman persecution. In Acts chapter 23, Paul's brought before the Jewish Sanhedrin, and he's rescued by the Romans again. They come in and they rescue him. The 40 Jews are in Acts chapter 23, by the way. 40 Jews vow not to eat until Paul is dead, and it's the centurion that takes Paul from Jerusalem and carries him down to Caesarea. And when he gets down to Caesarea, Paul is given liberty while he's there by the Roman governor. He's a prisoner in Caesarea. The text says he was given liberty, great freedom by Felix, but he was kept in prison to please the Jews. Acts chapter 25. Paul was charged before Festus. The Jews arrived there. Paul's put on trial. The Jews come all the way from Jerusalem to Caesarea to persecute Paul. And what does Felix say? Felix says, this man not guilty of any crime. And he kept Paul in prison, you know, hoping that there might be some underhanded money that was given to him to deliver him. What about Acts 26? When brought before Agrippa, Agrippa said, if this man had not appealed to Caesar, he would go free. He would go free. When you get to Acts 27 and Acts 28, Paul is there in Rome. He arrives in Rome and he is there to appear before Caesar. Every Jewish individual had a right to do that very kind of thing. When you get to the end of the book of Acts, 21 persecutions, 20 of them are Jewish in origin. That's the mindset that we do not have. Yes, you speak loudly, Gary. I'm a hearing aid. Both the other one just went out. Okay.
You said
He won?
In AD 70, when the Nero came, so God had mentioned in Matthew 24 that he was...
Yeah, we're headed there.
So he included this. I hadn't thought about what you're saying was they had killed the Son of God, but now also they've been persecuting the church.
Yes.
For all of these years, and then he comes in and...
Isn't that amazing? I know that, and that's a part of where we're headed in relationship. Gary's just one book ahead of me, and maybe into next week's lesson, in fact, and everything. Now then, when you get to the end of the divine history, can I show you two quotes from secular? You can find anything you want to improve anything by the internet. But I wanted to prove my point, okay? And so I went and found two sources, and I want you to know this is not presented as proof. I just want you to understand Dan is not crazy. I want you to understand that you study the book of Acts and your whole view of Roman persecution is changed. From if you've got Acts 2, that's about 33, and you get Paul in Rome, and that's AD 60 something another anyway. That's 30 plus years of history, and there's no Roman persecution. But here's the two quotations. Somebody asked the question on the internet, what is the place of freedom of worship under the state under a state religion? In ancient Rome, the state did not meddle in the private religious lives of its citizens, even though the gods were part of the community and lived among them. The Roman religion accepted diverse forms of worship, provided they did not seek to impose transcendence. In this essay, John Scale restores to the Roman government its proper place. You and I need to understand, even secular history says there was no Roman persecution. Now then, and that's where the point Gary was making, finally the time arrives in which the Romans decide to destroy not Christianity, but to destroy every believer in God. And so that Roman government came down and destroyed Jerusalem. Now then, let's get to the text. John sees Jesus on the Isle of Patmos. I don't have any more slides, so you need to open up your Bible. In the book of Revelation, these individuals who received this book would readily understand from this. In verse 4, blessed is he that read and those that hear the words of the prophecy of this book. And then John, having given the preamble in the first three verses, and by the way, when people come to these first three verses, they observe the Passover. They pass over these first three verses. I've got 20-something commentaries on the book of Revelation. Almost without exception, they start in Revelation chapter 1, verse 4. Why? It's a revelation. To seven churches in Asia. It's a revelation to seven churches in Asia. It's a revelation to seven churches in Asia in signs. It's a revelation to seven churches in Asia in signs of things which must shortly happen. I didn't make that up. That's almost a word for word quotation from these first three verses. So now John is writing to the seven churches which are in Asia. He mentions grace, he mentions the Lord Jesus, he mentions the Father. And then he says in verse 6, God has made us kings and priests to his God. And then he says, to whom be glory and dominion forever. Behold, he is coming in the clouds and every eye will see him. We'll comment about that later. I'm the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning, the end, says the Lord, who is and who was and who is to come. John, and look at this verse 9, John, both your brother and companion in, you got the New King James? The New King James reflects what the Greek says. You'd better underline in the New King James that next word. I am your brother in the tribulation. What tense is the word am? It's not future. I will be your brother in the tribulation. It's not past. I was your brother in the tribulation. I am your brother in the tribulation. Look in chapter 7, and we're getting ahead of ourselves, but in chapter 7, there are the 144,000. And he says, I said unto him, verse 14, Sir, who are my, I'm asked, who are these 144,000, those in the white robe? These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation. Isn't that amazing? The Greek's present tense. The New King James indicates present tense. I am your brother in those who are coming out of the great tribulation. And those two verses, the verbs in those two verses will force you to stop and to think about all of these books you've read about tribulations. All these books you've read about Revelation. This is a book written to those, and he says, I am your brother in the tribulation. And chapter 4, chapter 7, the great tribulation. Look at Matthew chapter 24. If you want to understand the presence of the thee and the importance of the word thee in the book of Revelation, you've got to get to Matthew chapter 24, and he says, pray that, verse 20, pray that your flight be not into winter or on the Sabbath, for then will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, and no, nor shall ever be. In AD 32 or 33, Jesus says there is coming a tribulation that is unlike any other tribulation there has ever been or ever will be. Now verse 34, he says, it's coming in this generation. That's verse 35. It's coming in this generation. And so in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus says in that first century generation was coming the worst tribulation there had ever been. What is going to precede the coming of the great tribulation? Looking back at verse 6, what will be the signs? Wars, rumors of wars, famines, earthquakes, pestilences. And then he says, but that's only the beginning. I ask you, what is in the book of Revelation? John says, I am your brother in the tribulation. Chapter 7, the great tribulation. And Jesus says, and it will be preceded, and there will be signs. He sent and signified it. There will be signs that precede the coming of the great tribulation. And guess what? That's 45 minutes into this class, and that's not a bad stopping place. Hold your breath. I would encourage you, if you want to become a Bible student, go home between now and next Sunday and read the book of Acts and become a first century Christian. First century Christian, when you get to the end of the book of Acts, is right before the time of the coming of the tribulation, right before the coming of the time of the great tribulation. And you read the book of Acts, and your view of the fact that the Roman government did everything it could to wipe out Christianity from the very day Christianity was born. Folks, it's wrong. It's wrong. But that's yet to be proved. That's the introduction. I hope you'll be coming every week to the study of the book of Revelation together. Thank you very much for listening today.